This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
After a while, the guy, the engineer, got up to go and have a piss. And John got up and locked the door, locked him out, and said, right. Let's make some fucking music then.
Let's get on with it.
Yeah, and that's it. That was my lucky break.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Let me pronounce your name correctly. Launay.
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 Launay. Yeah, we were wondering.
It's a French name.
Right.
I was about to say, okay, Nick, Launay.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome. You are record producer extraordinaire, so that people know who you are, what you do. And you're somewhere very exotic.
I am. I'm in Sydney, Australia, and it is 8 a.m., so I'm barely awake.
Right.
It's Wednesday, the 29th, so I'm kind of a day ahead of you.
Wow.
Yeah, we missed everything. My brother lives down in Australia, so I know this. He lives in Tasmania, so it's even weirder, right? So
all I know of Tasmania is the Tasmanian Devil and Blundstones.
They both exist.
Yeah.
Yes. My Blundstones came from Tasmania. I was very, very pleased.
Yeah.
And then they fell apart, you know.
I went to Tasmania once on tour. I had a few days off and we were going to play in Melbourne, you know. So I said to my brother, called my brother up. I hadn't seen him for years and I'd never been to Tasmania. And I called him up and said, oh, I'm going to come and see you. This is my flight number. I'll fly over and see you. I've got a few days off. And he went, great. I said, do you need to know the flight number? He says, no, I don't need to know anything. And I'm like, oh, really? You know, and I landed and I took this big plane from Melbourne and I landed.
Yeah.
And when I got there, I looked out the plane and I could see him on the tarmac, like waving at me, because the airport's about the size of my house.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it's Hobart is, that's a big town, really.
Hobart.
And it's great there. I mean, I didn't really know much about it until the museum was built, but I met David Walsh, who owns it, and he's, you know...
He owns Hobart?
It's an amazing story. He basically is a bit like Rain Man, let's
okay.
say. You can totally have a conversation with him and everything. He's a normal-ish person, but incredible mind, and he can basically look at any situation and understand the probability. So in other words, when he went to Vegas and started betting on things, he kept winning. So he made an absolute fortune. I mean, millions and millions and millions. And then went around the world buying incredible art. Not only art, but incredible things. Like, he owns quite a few mummies, real mummies. And, you know, sort of a lot of religious artifacts, and he commissioned you got Damien Hirst to make a Mickey Mouse out of diamonds.
Wow.
And it's all there. It's all there in Tasmania in this incredible.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. And not only that, where he's got this museum is so beautiful. It's like a lake above Hobart. Like, you know, there's the mountains behind Hobart. It's really beautiful there. And there's a lake. And then there's a peninsula that comes out into the lake. And he owns that. So rather than ruin this sort of beautiful landscape, he built it underground, and it's honestly like a James Bond movie type.
This is Thunderbird stuff. This is Gerry Anderson, yes.
It's really very, very Thunderbirds. It's like three, four layers underground, and it's got a cylindrical elevator made of glass.
Well, of course. What else could it be but cylindrical and made of glass underwater? We had one of those in Berlin in an atrium of a hotel, but it exploded a few days ago.
Uh-oh.
It was thousands and thousands of gallons of water in a cylindrical pipe, you know, on end, in the atrium of, like, you know, some international hotel.
Wow.
Full of fish. And, yes, full of fish. It was a tourist destination. You would stay at the hotel and you'd go and have lunch there and... we had this minus 14 degree snap last week, and the next day the papers. Well, I was going to say the next day the papers were full of it. The streets round about were full of fish.
Really?
Yeah, poor fish didn't make it. Nobody got injured because it happened around about 4 or 5 in the morning, and they just had a crack and a sort of shudder.
Wow,
sounds a bit dodgy putting glass elevators on in high pressure situations.
I think so, especially in a hotel.
Yeah.
So, I mean, was the elevator inside the fish tank?
You're right. There was an elevator inside the fish tank because you were apparently able, I didn't venture in myself, but you were able to get in there, you know, and blow kisses at the little angel fish as they went by. I don't know. Whatever tickles your fancy. I was feeling rough, but now you told me about the submerged island that came from fortuitous gambling in Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's an incredible. He's an incredible person, and it's nice to see that someone so wealthy, so incredibly wealthy, has spent it on building not only an incredible art museum, but it's also just full of the most extraordinary things. I mean, it's got like that Kevorkian. Box where you to kill yourself, you plug yourself in,
right.
Kill yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got one of those, and you go into this room on your own, and you put these straps on, right?
Oh, no.
And there's liquid that comes up the pipes, so you actually, it's incredibly intense because you know you haven't actually injected the thing into your veins, but the feeling of it, and it's Kevorkian's voice saying, "Yeah, you are now going to basically go to sleep."
Wow. No, I just switch my I switch my under blanket on because it's quite cold here, and it's quite nice. And sometimes I feel like I'm frying.
I had that. That feeling, that Kevorkian feeling, a couple of days ago, because I, you know, being of a man of a certain age, you know, they ask you to take a colonoscopy now and again.
Oh, yeah.
So I had the second one I'd had in 10 years, you know, and it was the best experience I've ever had in a hospital. I mean, they did the endoscopy as well, one down your throat, one up the other, you know.
Till they meet. They meet somewhere in the middle, don't they?
Yeah. It was like I was surrounded by like eight... like Vestal Virgins or something, and they brought me into this room.
Stop it.
And then they just said, "You're going to sleep now." And then it was gone, and I woke up.
No, they get it's the pentanol, lol. It's with the drugs they give you beforehand.
It was the drugs talking. I know it was the drugs talking, yeah. But it was the best experience I've had. And I hope that Dr. Ribisi doesn't hear this because she might think I was very weird. But no, it was really a good experience. Yeah.
I think it's a marvelous advertisement for her talents and skills.
Yeah. The last one was a bit like Nurse Ratchet, and it was terrible, but this one was great.
My surgeon in that department was called Ringo.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. said, "Oh, you're not a drummer, are you?" No, no.
It's like, I went to Jamaica this year, earlier this year. Zach Starkey is a good friend.
Yeah.
Went there, staying with him and his wife, Shush, and their baby, and went on a kind of a boat into this lagoon, and it ended up pouring down with rain, just like monsoon. And it was just me and a friend. And so we're paddling, like, and we ended up in the jungle, and there was these little shops, guys selling whatever they could sell. I mean, just absolutely, right. You know, flip-flops, you know, spray-painted with Jamaican flag kind of thing. And we went to one shop, and it says Ringo Starr's gift shop.
Yes.
Painted in, you know, very, you know, hand painted.
Right.
And this guy comes out and he goes, "Hey man, I'm Ringo Starr. What can I help you with?" You know, and we're just like, this is so weird because, you know, just up the road in this villa. And it was Ringo Starr's. So, of course, I went and got Zach and I said, you have to meet your other dad.
About 2 years ago, I bought the Beatles White Album again, you know, because it was remastered again and it's all been and I finally got my deck connected. I still haven't played it. I'm still looking at the book, the packaging. I'm reading about it. And then there was a little thing on YouTube with a lady who played the harp on She's Leaving Home.
Right.
Ringo, the White Album, Abbey Road Studio 2, and the ridiculous circumstances it took to get Susie and the Banshees into Abbey Road Studio 2 to start doing some recording one day. It was all to do with spilling champagne down the mixing desk of a studio around the corner in Camden Town.
I
mentioned it all because, Nick, where would you start? I mean, I know where you started, and I said we may have some friends in common. We may have some locations in common as well, for different reasons.
Yeah, we've been in the same studio complex many times, and we've definitely done this.
Ships passing, yes.
A lot. Yeah, I mean, I started at the townhouse. That was really the townhouse.
Okay.
Which is where mine and Lol's good friend Mike Hedges, I think, was our, not townhouse, he was at Battery somewhere.
Battery.
Morgan.
Yeah.
But we were in townhouse, definitely, because everybody went to townhouse looking for that Phil Collins wall, the drum wall, you know, the reflective stones.
That's it.
And I did read somewhere earlier on that you were there during the recording of or something, when Phil...
Yeah, I was an assistant engineer to Hugh Padgham, who was one of the engineers at Townhouse, and he was producing that album, that Phil Collins solo album, and that song, In the Air Tonight. Quite a lot of that album started off as Phil's demos.
Yeah.
And that song in particular, the drum machine, you know, and the main chords were his demo. And basically that was transferred onto multi-track and then his vocal and the vocoder and all that stuff. It's a very minimal song when you listen to it, right?
Yeah.
And so we know there'd been a couple of songs recorded with the drum sound because Phil wanted that drum sound because he had played on Peter Gabriel's third album.
Yes, that makes sense.
With that great song, Intruder.
Yes.
I personally, not the massive, I'm not a Genesis fan, and Peter Gabriel's stuff, some of it I like, some of it. But that album, that third album that has, you know, Kate Bush on it and, you know, Games Without Frontiers and that song Intruder, it's just incredible sounding. And the drum sound, that's where that drum sound first came up. Steve Lillywhite produced it and Hugh Padgham engineered it. And Phil loved that drum sound, so that's why he employed Hugh.
We could do a whole episode around what we're talking about right now. I'd love to.
Well, that drum sound is such an important thing. I mean, I you know, most of the records I made, because I learned how to get that drum sound.
Right.
Like the Flowers of Romance, which was the first record I did, has that drum sound, you know, and it's in that same room.
Yeah. I remember it. I remember sitting there playing the bass drum going like, why doesn't my bass drum sound like that bass drum? And how am I going to get there? You know?
The thing that was funny about In the Air Tonight was that he'd got that sound and Phil went out and he was just hovering over the drums with his sticks. And I was at the back of the room as a tape op, you know, and he was up there and we played it from the song, from the beginning of the song in record. And the whole song, he was just, I thought, is he playing? Hugh just cranked everything up. And then, you know, suddenly, after verse three, he went, brum, 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 brum. And I literally fell off my chair because it was so loud. Because, you know, I think Hugh thought he was going to do some brushes or something quiet.
So he's preparing for the delicate entry.
Yeah, it was a complete, overloaded the desk.
What year is this, Nick? What year are we talking here?
1980.
So I'm thinking in terms of where I was. I'd 79. I just joined the Banshees.
Yeah.
I'd just done the Slits' first album. And that came out. And was like going, it can't be Phil Collins. I just can't be, you know. Because it's going like, that's just the frigging best drum sound you've ever heard and the most unusual. And the whole thing was... And I there's several things, but Peter Gabriel's albums were a kind of on rotation with the Psychedelic Furs or something at the time,
right?
You know, I always thought it was Jerry Marotta who I thought he was playing on that album. I know Gabriel sort of did what Susie did to me, you know, took away the hi hat, took away the cymbals,
no hairspray.
No splashing, just get the drums down, which then became a way of recording drums to kind of so we could edit and cut cleanly.
Yeah, that room was so, I mean, it was all stone. The floor was slate. There was like very little wood and very little of anything else other than rock. So
you had some great bands come through. I mean, XTC would have come through Virgin as well at that point.
Yeah, that was actually, I assisted on the Black Sea album.
Yeah,
that was done just before the Phil Collins one, I think, or maybe just after it.
Underestimated drummer, Terry Chambers there.
Yeah, great drummer.
Oh, I love Terry. Yeah, apparently he's here.
He's probably around the corner. He's probably surfing right now with his son, who he says is a much better drummer than he ever was, which I can't believe. Because I was thinking, if I do another drum sort of talk, I will remember to mention, because I always forget, to say, who's your favourite drummer? Who was your big influence? I always go Ringo.
Right.
And it was probably more Mick Fleetwood.
Wow.
But Phil Collins, for sure, when he was playing on Another Green World with, what was his name? Percy.
Oh, Percy Jones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Brian Eno had picked up a lot of little snippets from Phil Collins over the years. And I remember one where he said, yeah, thanks, Brian. Wheeling us in the studio that you recorded everything and just paid his one session fee.
Wow.
Or something like this. Made a whole album out of Percy and Phil kind of really doing some amazing things. Little snippets of drums and...
Phil Collins is hilarious. He's just a really funny, funny person. I mean, you know, there's his public image, you know, which, you know, obviously when that In the Air... Nobody really knew, apart from, I guess, Genesis fans, but they didn't know him. And then he became that person and that sort of squeaky clean character. But, you know, he wasn't really squeaky clean at all. He really wasn't or isn't. And very, very funny. He constantly would be redoing sort of Steve Martin. He loves Steve Martin and a lot of stand-up comedians. And he was very good at imitating voices.
Yeah.
It's just constantly a laugh with him. I mean, it's sort of, I know the public image that he has, and it's he kind of isn't that. He's
You're right about him being very good at imitating voices, because when Gabriel left Genesis, you didn't really even know that he'd left Genesis.
Right.
Phil took over.
Yeah.
He was already doing a lot of the backing vocals for sure. All Phil anyway.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it sounds like I knew I was there.
Who was there?
I was there when he did the Lamb. You call it Lamb, don't they?
The Lamb, yeah. Lamb. I saw Genesis with Gabriel when I was like 13 at the Kennington Oval for £1.
Okay. Liverpool Empire, I think. I saw Selling England by the Pound.
Right.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
There you go.
See, I grew up in Spain, in the south of Spain.
Yeah.
Halfway up a mountain. And I went back to England in 1977.
Perfect.
Okay.
So, and I was still, you know... all my education was in Spanish, but I just went out. You know, when you live in Spain, Spanish people are outdoors all the time. So that I, regardless of the weather, I just went out to gigs. So the whole, you know, punk rock thing happened.
So you went from Andalusia.
Yes.
To where?
To London.
Camden Town.
More like Fulham.
Fulham. Fulham Broadway.
Yeah, yeah.
So you went to the Greyhound all the time?
Well, I went everywhere. I went everywhere. I had a skateboard. And I think I saw every single punk band you could mention, except for the Sex Pistols. I went to quite a few gigs.
So you'd have gone down the Music Machine.
Yes, all that. Yeah. And I just, you know, just lapped it up, because to me it was extremely exciting. Having grew up in a tiny village up a mountain near in the south coast called Frigiliana.
With the smell of oranges wafting down from Sevilla.
Yes, yes, and olives and all that.
And those big purple flying bees.
God knows what they are.
I don't know what they were.
Yeah. Loud.
We did an album down there. Me and Susie did the Creatures album, the second one, and we went
wow.
to
That's right.
Jerez de la Frontera.
Yes. Okay.
We were between I think Cadiz or Jerez and Arcos.
Okay.
De la Frontera.
I've heard of that place. I never went to that studio.
It wasn't a studio. It was a ranch, a bull ranch, by an ex-bullfighter called Fermin Borges. And we went there with Mike Hedges. We took the Abbey Road 16-track mobile.
Wow.
And when we got down there, my drums were so loud. It was in a bodega, you know, like
right.
stone walls, vaulted ceilings. And I think there was no separation in the room, so Mike Hedges was just watching the needles. He couldn't actually listen to what was going
right.
on the tape. It was just monitoring. And I just thought, God. This is crazy. We all thought it was crazy. You know, the power got sucked out when they were doing manufacturing and things.
So what I want to know is who drove the mobile down? Did Hedges drive it down? I can imagine him driving it down.
No. It was a very kind of trusted person from Abbey Road Studios, I think.
Oh, okay.
But it was just the idea of adventure, and also that there's one of those moments in time where your starting point was somewhere that I was very close to and remember with great affection and fondness, and like it's another world.
It's great down there. I mean, I still go there once a year, but my brother and sister still live down there. And it's just a wonderful
oh, okay.
part of the world. But it has nothing to do with punk rock.
Right.
So, you know, you can imagine like arriving in London
yeah.
as an amped up teenager.
Right.
And absolutely no limits, because my mum, who was very, she was very kind of rock and roll bohemian person. I mean, she's always listening to the Rolling Stones and had a lot of vinyl.
And I really think there's something to do with you that, because if you're anything like me, and I don't say we're similar, but I know I'm not like, I'm pretty good at what I do. I learned on the job. But I know there's thousands of great, really amazing drummers. And Phil Collins is like one that I just like put on a pedestal. So it must have been something else. There must have been something else that, like, got me into situations. Did you find that? What was going on that you found your way in?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing around with tape machines when I was 12, right, in Spain. My dad was a writer. He wrote books. And he would fly back to London and was on the BBC. And so he had him reading his stories, and it was broadcast probably on Radio 2 or 4 or something like that.
Right.
And so he had a tape machine, like Grundig's and stuff. So he gave me one of those, and I started editing and doing crazy stuff with tape, making tape loops and stuff with sticky tape. And I just loved electronic equipment. So then we moved back to London. I kind of just wanted to be in a recording studio, and I ended up at Tape One Studios. I don't know if you remember Tape One.
I remember Tape One. Yeah, that was always a reproduction place.
It was more of a mastering room.
Yeah.
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 And so my job really was to copy masters to send to different countries. So I had to learn how to line up tape machines, and I knew all about azimuths and boring things like that. And a song came in, an unknown artist, to be copied, you know, for release around the world. And I loved this song. I thought it was a great song. It was like Iggy Pop on a disco song. Yeah. And it was really cool. And the lyrics were kind of catchy. And so I thought it was great. And there was an instrumental version. So I edited for my own fun between the two versions, right? And then I'd use some tape loops and put some out of phase things and made this bizarre version of it. The mastering engineer, which is Dennis Blackham, who's also known as Bilbo Bopper, who probably mastered a lot of your records,
right?
Because he was one of the top guys back then in the late 70s, 80s. Right. He came in. It was probably 1 a.m. and I was still in this little room chopping away, you know. And he's like, what are you up to? And I said, well, this song came in and I really like it, and I've just done my own version of it. And he said, oh, let's hear it. So I played it to him.
Yeah.
And it was pop music. Do you know that song, pop music?
Radio video. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Boogie with a Suitcase.
That song. So, and Dennis just said, oh, this is great. You know, the singer is coming in tomorrow. So, do me a copy and I'll play it to him. I said, you can't do that. I've hacked his song up.
Yeah.
And he said, no, it's great. And I thought, okay, you know, I was 18, I suppose. So anyway, I ran off another copy. Next day, I'm working, knock, knock.
Who's there?
And Dennis comes in with Robin Scott, who was the singer.
Right.
Now, Robin Scott actually used to manage the Slits, so you must know Robin Scott. No, he did.
Came on the back of many people who were trying to manage the Slits.
Manage their Slits, right.
With Dick O'Dell and Frank Silver and Clive Langer.
Maybe he managed them for a week.
Yes.
Basically, he liked it, Robin Scott. Him and Malcolm McLaren were friends.
Right.
He said this new thing that they're doing in New York, that the DJs are mastering 12-inch versions of one song to make the low end louder.
Yeah, yeah.
And the song louder and the low end bigger.
Yeah.
The 12-inch mix was being born.
Yeah. Well, and he said, I want to put out the first commercial 12-inch single on pink vinyl. And I need a longer version, and here it is. It was 5.5 minutes long. And so that, basically, the song was released, the single version, and as you know, it was a massive hit. It went to number one, I think,
right,
in England. So it certainly went to number one in most countries. And then the 12-inch version came out shortly after and kept it up there in the charts.
Yeah.
So... So that was the first thing I ever had with my name on it.
Wow.
Because it's called the Nix Mix.
Oh, cool.
And, yeah.
That's very cool.
See, the thing is, it's cool now, but back then I was going like, I hate this. I hate it. Because it was all good. And
very professional. Very professional.
was going on though, right? It was what was going on at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was. It was the fight between punk and disco was going on, wasn't it? And this song was like, it was kind of a bit of both. And I don't know. I mean, but what happened was the fact that I did that got me the job at the Townhouse as an assistant engineer.
Right.
That's what got, I went for an interview and Mick Glossop, who was the chief engineer, you know.
That was your calling card.
I didn't go in there with that, but he said, what's your experience? And I said, I know how to line up tape machines. I know all about that. And I know this. And I did this thing. And then I gave him a copy and there's my name. So he thought, okay, this kid's obviously ambitious.
And you landed basically in the Glossop Padgham world of experience and
and then you know, and the next lucky break that happened was that I was put on a session with Public Image with John, and nobody else wanted to do it. Like, none of the other assistants wanted to do it.
Why is that, I wonder?
I don't know. I can't imagine. Verbal abuse, apparently.
He's always been lovely to me. I can't imagine that for a moment.
I know. Yeah,
he's a lovely guy. But I can see that some people might be a bit scared, you know.
He's still one of my best friends. I mean, I see him every year, which is more than I see a lot of people from back then. Yeah. You know, I've kept in touch, and he lives in LA. What happened was I was put on that session as an assistant, and the engineer that he brought in to do this kind of mix of an outtake from Metal Box.
Okay.
And the engineer basically was, either he was really high, he was a reggae remixer guy, but he wasn't. He was English. He had dreadlocks, but he was English, and he just didn't really have it together. He didn't understand how the desk worked. And I don't know who it was. I still to this day don't know who that was. But basically I ended up, from my chair at the back of the studio. Right? But every time I'd go up to the desk to explain that you pull the knob up to switch it on and then you turn it, I'd go back and then it would happen again. And he says, this one doesn't work. And I go, yeah, you just pull it up and you do this. And then after a while, John said, oi, what's your name?
Yeah.
And I said, that's Nick. And he said, well, Nick, get your fucking chair, put it up near the desk, because you're going backwards and forwards like a fucking yo-yo. And so I brought my chair up. And then I kept reaching over and doing it every time he didn't. And after a while, the guy, the engineer, got up to go and have a piss. And John got up and locked the door, locked him out, and said, right, let's make some fucking music then.
Let's get on with it.
Yeah, and that's it. That was my lucky break.
I mean, that to me just said, that says, you say lucky break, you could say serendipitous moment, but really, it's you. It's you and the age you're at,
Yes. It's youthful enthusiasm.
Why shouldn't it be me? I can do this. I'm that guy doesn't know what he's doing. But you don't go kind of in there and go, oh, I'm not sure if I should. And I'm sure you must have achieved, there must be many moments where that, if you like, attitude, is what kind of turned something around.
Well, that attitude definitely turned it around for me, because, you know, when I first saw like the Clash play, I was like, okay, I can do this now. I know what they're doing. I can do it.
I can do that, yeah.
You know, whereas I'd been watching, you know, ELP and Genesis before, I'm like, no, can't do that. How the hell do you do that? I can't do that. But, I saw the Clash and I thought, yeah, I can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and when you're young like that, you do think you can do everything,
sure,
don't you? You know nothing, so you can do it all.
so then you worked with you went on to Killing Joke and probably others, and
yep.
at some point you must have met up with Dennis Bavell, Mr. Blackbeard, for the Slits second album.
Yes. Well, what happened with the Slits was that connection was in a way through John, I guess, because John was already with Nora.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, actually, because I haven't really... It was just this thing where, because that Flowers of Romance record was so bizarre sounding
right.
and interesting, to especially to musicians,
yeah.
I got a lot of calls. I mean, I had no manager.
I was always a little jealous, in a way. I'd moved out of the Slits camp, and it was... It wasn't hard to leave. It was hard to leave, but it wasn't like I was leaving to do something else, which was strange. I kept falling into the next situation. And so the call for Susie and the Banshees was unexpected, even right to the moment when the manager called me. I didn't know who he was. But it was like then the Slits went on to really try and forge a whole new sound for themselves. And
right. Were you in the Slits at the first version? Of the Slits.
The second version. So I knew Palmolive. I knew Paloma, the original drummer.
Right.
And I met the band while they were playing as Slits. My first band in Liverpool, my little punk band, we would open for the Slits. We'd come to London. We'd stay at Nora's house.
Right.
We got to meet Viv and Tessa. And I remember riding in the car around the King's Road with Ari and Viv, and we picked John up. And John was going, "They're after me, Viv. They're after me." She's, "Oh, shut up, John. Everybody's after you." Yeah,
they probably were back then, like the Teddy Boys and stuff.
Oh, he's a funny guy.
Yeah, yeah. No, so I did that first album. I knew the songs. We reworked them with Dennis at Ridge Farm. Did a lot of rehearsing. We went through many producers, many engineers and producers had a go at working with them, and it was Dennis that kind of pulled it off, really.
Right. Basically, I only did two songs. I did Earthbeat,
yeah,
and there was what's the other song? It was the B side, but it was actually really good. And both of them ended up on the Earthbeat album. But right. I basically produced them, recorded them on my own, and then Dick O'Dell came in when we were mixing.
Okay,
and that was it. It was very quick, and it also it wasn't. At the Townhouse. We recorded at some other studio because the Townhouse wasn't available. And then it was mixed at the Townhouse.
Right.
But I remember it was great, really great fun. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Another person you've worked a lot with is Nick Cave.
Yeah. When did you work with him? Berlin?
No, it was way before that. I was probably in the Banshees, and there's a lady by the name of Annie Hogan.
Okay.
A pianist, keyboard yeah. player. And she'd written all these songs, and she had a song called Vixo. And we were at North End Studios. I think it was at TW Studios. It was a real no-name studio. And I got the call to go over there with Annie. And Nick was there. It was really late. There was no drum kit. There was a tambourine. There was a snare drum. There was a crappy old ride cymbal. I was playing some harmonica. Nick was playing some harmonica, I think. And Annie was doing the piano. And we just cut this track. And I loved it. And he only had a cassette version of it for about 20 years, maybe longer.
What era was this? Like, was this like...
It's got to be 80 tops, 70.
Yeah, well, that was because the first time they came to London... was 19, yeah, end of 80, because I did this song called Release the Bats.
Yes.
Yes.
In that same right. studio.
Right.
And so that was when it must have been. So that was literally when I...
You were in the other room. You'd gone home.
I was in the other room.
I saw the birthday party played at the Covent Garden Rock Garden.
Right. Yes.
And I was at that gig. There was not a lot of people there.
I didn't go to that gig.
I could pretend I went to that gig, and so that, you know, I could be in the, I was all there somewhere, you know.
Yes, we were all there. We were all there, clearly.
And I was drinking for us all, and when they finished, I steamed off. I found the dressing room, and I went in and I said, "You guys are fucking great. You're rah, rah, rah." And they go, "Who's this nutter? Get him out of here."
Yeah. I remember that. That was about the same time as I would go to the marquee and somebody, I would walk in the marquee and somebody would go to me, oh, no, Robert's here. He's up by the bar. And I go, really? Because I'd know that I'd just left him back in the studio, you know, the other side of town. And I'd walk up to the bar and there'd be somebody who looked a little bit like Robert.
Yes, because he had the same hair.
Yeah. And so I get my drink and I just stand next to them and watch them freak out when they realized, you know, that, like, oh, this guy's nose.
There was the nights that, you know, queuing up outside the Batcave, you know, to get in. And because I never like going to the front of the queue because you could.
Yeah, right.
You know, do you know who I am?
Yeah.
And me and Susie were there one night, and like five people in front, there's me and Susie stood there, looked like, we're already going in. There was like identical from the back, you know, blonde hair, black hair.
Yeah.
Pretend he was Bob, going to places and pretend he was Robert. Yeah. You know, he'd get away with it all the time as well.
I used to pretend I was me, you know.
Yeah. Well, I had many years of pretending I was me. It took a long time to find the real me.
What an amazing time that was. I mean, you two, and especially because you were in bands making great music and, you know, part of that whole thing.
You're kind of like heads down. You're not. I always remember that quote saying, "Be careful not to read rubbish because you might end up writing it." It was somebody writing for The Guardian, a real serious writer. But there was a lot of that where you kind of blinkered out. You know, Visage were happening over here, and John McGeoch was playing guitar with us and doing, you know, moonlighting with Steve Strange. You know, we're saying, well, Steve can't have a band.
Right.
You know, Steve was one of the first guys I met when I went to London. He showed me how to shoplift on the King's Road. You know, don't shoplift there. Go to Boy. They're much, like, better quality.
Wow.
You know, Dago. So Visage were, like, made some money very quickly. They had motorcycles. They were endorsed by Yamaha, the guitar.
Well, that one song. I thought that one song. I mean, Fade to Grey, I thought. I'd love that song to this. It stands up very well. It sounds great today.
Agreeing,
it's always sounded great. I don't know how that came together, but it's, and you know, that club. So you must have gone to
the Blitz
club.
Debauched. It was all debauched.
Yeah, right.
I don't know how they let Spandau Ballet in. You know, the dress code was like really lax.
And they let that David Bowie chap in.
They did.
It must have been amazing, though.
It was a lot of stuff happening. Being a young guy from like Northwest England, sort of landing in the centre of it, you know, really in the eye of the movers and shakers. I mean, I'd been to London to watch Suicide opening for The Clash.
Wow.
You know, and I was so drunk, I saw like, there was eight people in Suicide, you know. Well, they're a big band.
And they all look the same. I'm just remembering something. So at the Townhouse, it would have been just after I did Flowers of Romance, I had a meeting with The Cure, with you.
Okay.
Well, there was four of you.
Yeah.
And, oh, God, it was really...
Terrible?
No, it was great. You released the singles, right? You had there was a couple of singles that ended up being an album.
Oh, yeah, for Japanese Whispers.
Right, and I remember buying those... And I knew, obviously, The Cure. And then it was this meeting.
Right.
And I remember it being sort of great and sort of awkward because I think Robert was very shy. And we talked. And then my memory of it was a meeting for me to perhaps work with The Cure.
Oh, okay.
And then it didn't happen because I had done... the Public Image records.
Oh.
Now, whether it was because someone didn't like that or didn't like John or there was something...
Well, that's funny because it wouldn't have been... I remember going to the Townhouse and having some meeting, and I apologise if I don't remember that it was... You know, I believe you when you say it was you. It wouldn't have been either me or Robert that didn't like Public Image because we both loved them, you know?
Oh, no, yeah. That was just probably my thoughts. I probably thought
maybe it was the manager, because at that time, if there was like four of us, I don't know. Maybe that was like 17 seconds, maybe.
Yeah.
Not, no, maybe it was after or something.
It was just after
but
that.
I remember around that time we had Hedges. We worked with Hedges for the first three albums, and then we went to see, we had quite a lot of different people come in and talk to us, and Connie Plank, we had a meeting with Connie Plank. He'd just done Killing Joke, and he impressed us a lot because he was like this big brooding German guy dressed all in leather, and he came and sat next to us in the office, and he went, "I've just finished the record with Killing Joke. You know, the sound, it's like an animal.
It's animal."
Yeah, so we were like, "Oh yeah, we like him." And then he died, so that we could have him. So we end up working with Phil Thornley, who was 21 when he did Pornography. You know, it was like ridiculously young.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know,
and it's all very. What I'm realizing is that we in the bands were a little older than the fans. You know, we were punk rock, if you like. It was happening for 14-year-olds. We were already like 20 in our 20s, and we'd grown up on like 70s rock,
right?
Or German experimental music, or there was a lot of reggae in my background. There was a lot of reggae came in from Jamaica around late 69, you know, and plus the Stones and the Beatles, all that stuff as well. So we kind of came, what punk did was give us the impetus and the facility to do something.
Yeah, yeah.
To do, but we brought a lot of stuff. We almost started as post-punk. You know, we quickly jumped into the world of ideas rather than the Ramones cliche, you know, of even though the Ramones were the star attraction.
Yeah, like the label post-punk is now such a thing.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I get asked to work with so many bands now because post-punk is, you know, this popular thing. And it's become a name that people relate to that whole era. And in a way, I think, well, The Cure and Susie and the Banshees were the main bands.
I apologise, you know, that we didn't work with you back then. If I'd known what I know now, I would have said yes.
Yes. It's a damn shame. Yes. It's a damn shame.
Never say never, lol. Never say never.
Never say never, yeah.
I was so, I mean, I was barely 20, and it was all just very bizarre to me because, you know, I grew up in Spain.
Right.
So I didn't, it was suddenly, I was still living at home with my mum, and to suddenly be working with Johnny Rotten was crazy enough.
Great.
And then all this other stuff, you know, it's insane.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.